this redefines failure. You only fail if you're not giving, if you're not sacrificing, and you have control over that.
That is, I think you put it in the best words I've heard. I always say my life actually didn't really start until I had my kids. Guys, welcome back to Failure. This is the place where, as they say, success has many fathers and failure has none. Well, failure has found a father, and you're here with us.
I'll ask you a couple questions. Let's flip the script.
That's failure, by the way. Sacrifice in a way.
In a way. That's when, but if you redefine it, which I do, as success. So I'll give you an example, or you'll give us an example. What are the two things that mean the most to you in your life?
My kids.
Your kid. Let's make that one.
Okay.
What's second?
My family.
Okay. Your kids and your family. What are the things you've sacrificed the most for in your life?
Now?
In your, over the year, what?
Well, originally business, before I had kids and family. Definitely business.
But they became most important.
Now, it's my kids and my family.
Bingo. So what have we just discovered?
What you sacrifice, what you get that's most important is what you give is most important.
The things that mean the most to us.
Are the things we
sacrifice the most for. That's what draws us near. So my next book, I'm not sure what the title is going to be. Right now, I'm thinking of How Love is Made.
It's a good title.
So it's counterintuitive. You see, it's not that we sacrifice for the people we love. It's that we love people because we sacrifice for them.
I mean, yeah, like any father or mother would give everything for their kids and also get the most from them.
And so this redefines failure. You only fail if you're not giving, if you're not sacrificing, and you have control over that.
That is, I think you put it in the best words I've heard. So I always say my life actually didn't really start until I had my kids. And it wasn't even the day that Tommy was born. It was like a year in when I kind of really realized my life didn't really, it's not it didn't matter, but like.
It was real love.
It was real love and.
Born.
Yep.
Of sacrifice.
Yes.
Right? Children are actually, babies are born in pain. They're created in love and born in pain. And you sacrifice for them. And let me tell you something about parenting, okay? Since I'm your old rabbi buddy, it never ends.
Now they say, what do they say? You're only as happy as your least happy child, right?
Until the day you die. It never ends. So once you get this idea that love is something you make through giving, then that changes how you see your life. And it enables you to live a life of nothing but success.
That is how I wake up every day, only because my success is purely how good of a father am I? That's how I look at it.
And you know what? It's born of a broken heart.
Yeah.
I won't get too like.
No, I love this because this
too rabbi like on you. But so there's a verse in the Bible that says God puts God's words upon our hearts. And the rabbis ask a really interesting question, which is why upon our hearts and not in our hearts? I mean, surely if God has the power to put words on your heart, God has the power to put words in your heart. And the answer they give, which I think is so powerful. The answer they give is God puts words upon our hearts. And it isn't until our hearts are broken that the words can enter.
Wow.
In other words, in a way.
He puts it there, but we have to.
We're more whole when we're broken.
I think that's very true.
I'm not telling you it's any fun.
No.
But I'm telling you it's something other than failure.
You know, I remember, I don't know if you remember this. You came to the hospital. My wife, Jessica, was in the hospital with Tommy. She'd been on bed rest. Couldn't get out of bed for 6 months because she went into premature labor. I think she'd get out for 5 minutes a day or 10. My company had just had the hospital taken into bankruptcy, and I was working out of the hospital trying to keep it out of bankruptcy or get it back out of bankruptcy. And I remember you came in, and in my mind, my life was over. Like, I wasn't sure if my child was going to make it.
Right.
It was front page of every paper being kind of shit on trying to, thinking I was never going to get this back. In fact, I remember right when you walked in, I just told Carl Icahn to go fuck himself and hung up because he was supposed to help me and then was going to try and steal it. And you, I remember you came in and you said, you know, first of all, you said this too shall pass, which was the very, and I stopped. I was like, that's what my Nana would say, which I don't remember the exact words, but more or less you said, you know, I know everything feels inescapable or uncontrollable right now. And it wasn't that it happens for a reason, but it's, I promise you, when you look back on this, it won't be as bad as you think it is. And you'll grow from it. It was something to that extent.
Well, I think about these things almost like, have you ever been like face to face on the dock with one of those massive cruise ships?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. As they head out to sea, they do become smaller.
It's true. And smaller until they go.
Yeah. And we do have this amazing ability to normalize things. During COVID, I remember saying on, you know, the talk shows and everything, and I was saying, look, this is a risk that's new, and therefore we haven't been able to normalize it. But you get on the 405 every day,
yeah,
and you're a lot more likely to die there. It's just that you've normalized it. You've learned to live with it. We are going to learn to live with this too, which we did, because human beings are amazing. Because when you must, you can. And it doesn't mean it doesn't hurt, but it does, if you live a certain kind of life, it takes the sting out. If you have people who love you and will support you, if you're willing to ask for help, if you've led a life of giving, of sacrifice, it doesn't change the decree. It doesn't change what happens to you. But it changes the way you go through what happens to you.
You know, what's very interesting about that is, you know, I like you, I studied physics, and I remember you did your
my rabbinical
your
thesis
rabbinical
was
thesis on Einstein. And yeah, he's, as you know, he's my hero.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I ever told you this, so everybody in the world's going to see this, but I have a tattoo.
Really? I'm not sure I want to see it, but please continue.
It's E=mc². On my back, actually, which I made a confession to a rabbi.
You're not the first.
I've been reading a lot about some of the more recent breakthroughs in physics and quantum physics, which is my hobby. And, you know, there's this notion, wave particle duality, which I'm sure you've studied. And there's a notion now that the reason we can't observe wave particle, is that we see in 3D. Obviously, and the world actually exists in 5, 6, or 7D. And so it's not, you know, time is relative. So the past isn't the past, the future isn't the future, and there really is only the present, and that's it. And a lot of people who, Michel Kaku's of the world, these big physics, I'll call them scholars, trying to help people say, you know, the past happened, but it doesn't have to always have happened. Meaning, every second you get to choose your new path. And it's kind of...
Well, yeah, the way I put it to people, when people come to see me, let's say you were coming to see me about some moral failure or business failure or whatever, could have, should have, would have. The first thing I would say to you to triage the experience, I mean, what I'm about to say is a blunt instrument.
Yeah.
But you got to start there.
Yep.
To get you headed in the right direction, I would say, I don't know about you, Ryan, but personally, I've given up all hope of a better past.
That's a great, I'm going to use that line from now on. I'm stealing it for sure.
Think about it. It immediately points you in the right direction.
And
it's triage.
It's interesting because it's triage and it's metaphysical and it's scientific. And when I say scientific, the whole theory now that, when I say the whole theory, one of the many theories, but there are actually a lot of science behind it and Einstein's equations hold true. That is, you know, we actually can effectively live any path out of any probability. And part of what we do to ourselves by sticking ourselves in the past and getting stuck in the failure.
Past is prologue.
Exactly. We're picking, you know, the future.
Yeah. And dimensions to the world.
Right. Infinite dimensions.
Infinite dimensions, because we don't see the world as it is. We see the world as we are.
Correct. We see the world from our eyes.
Only.
We just talked about this on our last show, actually, where, I don't know if you ever studied Cooley, sociologist and a psychiatrist, but I just remember from college, he was a...
Stephen, was he the guy, the bowling alone guy? No, that was...
No.
Yeah, yeah.
He was, like, just prior to Freud, he created the looking glass self. We don't see ourselves. We think we see ourselves.
Yeah.
We see ourselves the way we think other people see us. And he called it the looking glass self. So when we're looking in the mirror, we're actually looking at what we think other people see.
Right.
And it's an interesting, when you put yourself in that.
Well, let's just say that, I mean, it's all relative.
It's all relative.
Okay. And this, again, is why less judgment and more empathy is such a powerful way to live.
It's like words I wish the... I wish the whole world, in a way, could go through their painful moment early in life. The world would be such a better place.
And that's... But it takes time. It takes time. You have to have the time to assimilate it and embrace it. In other words, when you're cracked open by something painful or disruptive, you call it failure. I call it life.
Yep.
It takes a while. I'll tell you something. When I was, 30 years old, I decided to start a men's group at the temple, and I called it 100 Jewish Men. And I invited 100 men, ages 25 to 80, and we got together once a month, and we talked about things that men would never talk openly about with women in the room and that were unique to men. And one of the things we did was called an age circle. So the youngest guy stands here, the next youngest here, all the way across. So the oldest guy and the youngest guy are shoulder to shoulder. And then we got to ask questions across the circle.
What a cool idea.
So when you're talking across the circle, you're talking to someone either 30 years older or 30 years younger.
That's really cool.
And everybody got to ask a question. So I was 30, I'm looking at these 60-year-old guys, and I say to them, you know, already in my short time as a rabbi, it had been like 3 years, so it's very clear to me that men in their 60s and 70s are the happiest, the most content, the most at peace with themselves and their life and what they will and will not accomplish and be and do. And then I looked at him and I said, is there anything you guys over there can tell us over here about how to achieve that state without having to live all the years it takes to get to stand where you are? 20 guys all look at me and they go like this. Nope. Can't have your second child first.
It's such a great, you definitely need to write that book. Because that is such a great, like, as you said, I even laughed.
You can't write the book.
No, you can't.
It's a great title, but you can't write the book.
No, but the book should actually be called that. You can't have your second child first. You know, yeah. You and I share something that I don't think we've ever talked about. When I was 14, I was diagnosed with anxiety disease. And it was like the hardest thing I ever went through. And I've lived it my whole life. And when I was a kid, it wasn't okay. Like, anxiety wasn't a thing. It took 2 years of me telling my parents I have that feeling. And a shrink one day said, you know, he has anxiety disease. And, you know, my dad, like, it's like, no, you don't.
It's a fake disease.
Go do it. That's not real. That's, you know, in your brain. And I've my whole life had it. And I actually think back on a lot of the things that I would have, you know, it's interesting because I don't go back and think I wish I would have done something differently. And even recently.
You couldn't have, because you can't have a better past.
Really, you can't. But more than that, I often think, you know, like, okay, well, in this metaphysical world, if I could have had, you know, there's all these different lines and I could have had this alternate timeline, what would I have changed? And it's actually nothing. In my mind, it's nothing. But the one thing I do think about are little things. Like, I didn't do that because I had anxiety. And it's not a big thing I didn't do. It's actions. Like, when I was in business and even the peak of my career and even when certain things weren't going well, one of the biggest complaints I got was not calling people back. And they thought I was doing it because I thought I was too good or too big and it wasn't that. It
was, you were afraid.
Anxiety. I oftentimes would cancel last minute for a party or an event and people thought, oh, he's rude. It was anxiety.
Yeah.
To this day.
You were afraid.
Yeah. And I wish, when I think back, that's the thing I wish I could change, is because that I could have changed very easily. It would never have changed an outcome. Maybe it would have made one, but, you know, it was the fear.
You suffered too long.
I still have it, but I've learned to live with it. And you have it.
I came out about it because I suffered too long. You know, the problem or the challenge of an underlying anxiety disorder is it's also your friend, because I treated every day of work as if it was my last, because I was going to get fired if I didn't crush it, outperform every other rabbi in all of American Jewish history every day, return every call, raise every dime, write books, run a congregation, all driven by anxiety. And so the very thing that makes you successful is the same thing that enslaves you. And that's, again, another duality, right?
It's so true.
I said dualities drive life forward, that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. So what happened in my case is this was in 2020. Now, I'd had it my whole life. I grew up afraid, in a house full of fear.
Yep.
My dad used to say things like, when I hit, I break bones. Who says that to a six-year-old?
Yeah, it's tough.
Who says that?
Yeah.
And when I would come home from college, and we weren't poor, we just lived like we were poor. Because my dad grew up on what was then called public assistance, SNAP, essentially. I would come home from college and my dad would say, come here. And we'd walk out in the backyard and he'd say, under that tree, I buried some gold coins. God forbid we should ever have to buy bread. It's like, what? So I have all of this. Wow. Always had all of this and never understood it, except it drove me hard. Hard. Okay. That's how I did it. You ask, I don't know how you did it all, how you do it all.
Yeah.
That's how. Fear, anxiety. Now, in 2020,
it eventually catches up to you.
Oh, it always catches up to you. I behaved in very dysfunctional ways. I was belittling. I was judgmental. I was tough on the young rabbis around me. Why can't you do what I can do? I grew bitter inside because they couldn't be what I, you know, I was, wasn't nice. I got away with it because I was nice externally, but internally, I was burning up. And, you know, when I had this car accident, I had the spinal surgery and all of that, I thought, I'm not going to be able to be at work what am I going to do? They're going to get rid of me.
Yeah, that anxiety is the worst.
Okay. So then in 2020, the day before Trump leaves the White House, the day before, I had stayed above the fray for 4 years. I said to the congregation, I'm not a pundit. I'm not going to talk about these things. It's not productive.
I remember, actually.
Yeah. And I don't know any more than you know.
I remember when you said that.
Yeah. You can read the Wall Street Journal.
Yep.
I can read the Wall Street Journal.
I actually remember it was kind of part of your sermon, but it was kind of before. And it was like, I'm not involved in this.
No.
It's not my job.
And this is called a sanctuary for a reason.
Yeah.
We're not going to have it here.
I kind of remember you telling people, like, it's not a place to debate this stuff.
That's right. So then the day before Trump left the White House, he issued all the pardons. And for the first time in the history of the United States, he also published a list of everyone who wrote a letter supporting the pardon of every person he pardoned.
And you had written a letter?
And I had written a letter for someone.
I bet I can guess who.
I'm sure you can. And he deserved it.
He did deserve it.
Because he changed his life. Because I worked with him. Because I knew the inside of it.
Yeah.
That no one else knew.
Yeah.
And because I understood in a way no one else understood except his family, what the consequences of no pardon would have been. And this is a person who changed his life because of his mistakes. And also, I'm not the judge. I'm not the jury. Right. I'm not the president.
You're also just writing what you feel.
Yeah.
You said,
I was writing based on experience.
Yeah, I see firsthand witness of a person who deserves something as a rabbi.
That's right. So it gets published, and I had no idea, of course. It never happened before. I would have written the same letter, but I would have been prepared.
Yeah.
And Mara, my social media manager, my phone rings. She says, did I just hear your name on MSNBC? And I said, I don't know. Maybe. Why? And then it starts pouring out. And then, because the hatred for Trump.
People gave you shit for that?
You have no idea.
But you would have written it whether it was a Republican, Democrat, or
I would have written it.
And by the way, for someone who's a great family person, I deserved it.
I would have written it to Obama
for
David Geffen. Okay. Yeah, not that he needed it, but like, yeah. And they would have thrown a parade for me down Wilshire Boulevard.
Yeah.
But it happened to be Trump, who is obviously a polarizing figure.
Yep.
And a Republican, and people couldn't, they lost their minds. First of all, people in groups lose their minds.
Yeah.
We're seeing that now.
Yeah.
They lose their minds.
Yeah.
You know, I always subordinated the anxiety that was locked in the basement of my psyche with hard work. I just kept working hard, and that kept the anxiety in the basement. It was always, right? It was always pounding on the ceiling of the basement with a broomstick. Like, we're here.
Yep.
We're animating you, but it was locked in the basement. For whatever reason, this experience flung the basement door of my psyche open, and the anxiety rushed out. And I was paralyzed.
Yes.
I lost 10 pounds.
Oof.
I was putting out fires of people who I thought loved and trusted me, but who were so blinded by their hatred and so deeply moved by the people who stood up for me. I had a board member who said, I will not be on a board of a synagogue that tells the rabbi what he can and cannot say. I had people say and do the right things, and I had people who really...
I can't believe the board would even question you. Like, what's wrong with that?
It was you try to remember the ethos.
I know it's polarizing, but you weren't supporting a Republican or Democrat, or you were just people
writing
lose, to the president.
People lose their minds. And by the way, I didn't invent the presidential pardon, which I think is a weird thing and probably not appropriate, but I didn't invent it. Anyway, the important thing is that despite that unleashing of an underlying anxiety disorder that I kept suppressed, I had been seeing a psychiatrist since the car accident.
Yeah.
And I said, I don't want to live like this. I cannot live like this.
It's so debilitating.
So he started me on Zoloft.
Same thing I'm on.
And then, so I take 125 milligrams of Zoloft.
I took 150, I'm down to 100.
Yeah.
But I've whole life been on, I've been on every one of them, and I went through until I found the one that worked.
I think that we should put Zoloft in the water supply like fluoride.
Okay? I'm in total agreement with you.
What happened was, you know, I was still suffering, really suffering, and it was getting a little better. And then, I don't know, 8 weeks into it or something, someone said to me, "Hey, Steve, how you doing?" I said, "Great." Then I went,
"Yeah, it takes great. Takes about 2 months to kick in."
Who's that guy? Great. What? So then I decided it was Mental Health Month. You know, there are all these months in America. Sure. So it was Mental Health Month, and it was time for me to do one of my Today Show segments. And I said, this is what I want to talk about. I want to tell the truth about what happened to me. And I want to share with people that store-bought is fine. We need to destigmatize. You know, I need these.
Yep.
Or I could never be a rabbi.
Yeah.
Nobody cares because we've normalized it. If you had diabetes, you wouldn't hesitate to take insulin.
No.
You wouldn't have, nobody. Why does this have to be something other than normalized? It wasn't in a gratuitous or voyeuristic kind of way. There was nothing sensational about it. It was just the truth. I was suffering. I needed help. I sought help. I got help, and it changed my life. And did it reduce my ambition a little? Yes. Is that a great trade?
Yeah.
Yes.
All day long. As someone who suffers from anxiety, all day long.
All day long.
Interesting that, because you kind of...
Remember how we started? That when someone comes to me to talk about what they perceive as a failure, the first thing I do is ask myself, where is that in me?
Yeah.
Because that enables me and others to realize, like, you're not alone. The calls after that episode, the parents reaching out at me to help needing help for their kids.
It triggered a lot, right?
A lot. And I'm so glad, because if one anxious kid got on Zoloft because of that episode, and I know many more than that did, then Ezra Spice Handler's
three
admonition was right.